Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, welcome to Hollywood Crime Scene. This is Rachel Fisher.
Hi, this is Desi Jettikin.
Desi, let's start the show by thanking the wonderful people who subscribe to our Patreon. This past week, we have a Patreon account. It helps support the show. And in return for your subscription, you will have access to all of our bonus content over at Patreon, including ad-free episodes. There's a lot of shit up there. There's like 350 shows up there.
Wow. That's a lot.
There's a lot of
There's years, and you can access to it immediately.
Yeah, as soon as you sign up. Anyway, this week we had Natalie, Sarah, Mackenzie, Courtney, Andrea, Angelique, Sana, Patricia, Jones, Jackie, Laura, Christine, Kathleen, another Christine, Sarah, Liv, Mary Catherine, Peyton, and Ruby. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
I'm wondering if the Jackie who subscribed has the same last name of as an old friend of mine. Write into the show or DM me on Instagram if that's you.
Okay.
You have the same last name as my friend. But thank you.
Okay. So first of all, I was shocked that the story was this year. But this story broke in March of 2022. And it was pretty wild. It immediately captured everyone's attention. And it's still fascinating to this day. I mean, people are still talking about it. And as I'll mention at the end, there was a new interview with the person we're going to talk about today, Elizabeth Finch. And we'll be doing a special mini episode with that new interview. So, yeah, this story is about a writer named Elizabeth Finch. She worked on Grey's Anatomy. And sort of the way she really made it in the business by was talking about her personal traumas and using those stories in her work, whether it was working for a TV show, writing essays. She said that she had cancer, but she had other things she said to get attention and sympathy, other traumas, not just the cancer. So she really used these to get this attention she so fucking needed. And she used this to build her career. And as we've talked about probably before, this is really a golden age where people sort of mine their trauma for personal and professional gain.
Yeah.
Now, of course, the major difference is that she made it all up.
Right.
That's sort of, and you can have an opinion about what the ethical, you know, or what, how that, if you think that's a good thing or not, that people use their trauma to kind of get work and whatever.
And of course, not everybody.
No, not everyone does it.
And there have been some great essays by people who are vulnerable, but
it's definitely though a thing where I think it's like not even shocking anymore that people do it. I remember when what would be shocking that people would reveal trauma. It was like, whoa, like I've never heard a story like that before. And now I feel like you see it all the time. Like, it's just interesting.
It is interesting. People are a lot more open with sharing pretty intimate details about like the worst things that have ever happened to them before.
Right. Which I'm sure has benefits because you shouldn't be ashamed about those things.
But then you get people like this woman who sees attention that people are getting and is like, oh, I could have that.
And this is like a subject I'm very interested in. There's been a ton of memoir writers, too, who have been busted for elaborating, not always out and out lying. But, I mean, I hope to cover those cases sometimes because I just really, I'm into it.
Like that Million Little Pieces guy.
James Frey.
Remember he got in trouble?
That was a huge deal because he was like the Oprah book club pick.
Everyone was obsessed with that book and it like, I don't know. It came out like before I got sober, but I remember like people at my sober living had that book. Like,
oh yeah.
They were like, cause it was just so big. Everyone had that book, but like people would ask me, people who weren't sober would ask me if I had read the book. I'm like, no, I haven't read his fucking book. And then it came out that he was like elaborating or embellishing stuff. And I'm like, see,
well, I remember too, the book Running with Scissors. Wait, I read that book.
That too had a scandal.
Yeah. A lot of it was made up.
Wow.
Or exaggerated.
Well, Desi, I'm on the edge of my seat waiting, even though I did read the, but you know what? I want to hear the stuff you dug up.
Okay. Well, I mean, everything I've dug up is probably things you've read, but I used a two-part article in Vanity Fair called Scene Stealer, The True Lies of Elizabeth Finch. This is by Eugenia Peretz. There's tons of stuff I looked at on Vulture. And then the main sources for this are the Ankler articles. The Ankler is a showbiz like newsletter, but it's like in depth. They broke the story, the original story. It was called The Talented Ms. Finch. It is written by Peter Kiefer. I mentioned the follow-up interview that will be in the mini episode. It's also written by Peter Kiefer, but I'll give it a plug at the beginning of that episode as well. I also just really read a ton of blog posts, but it all ends up having like the same information because everyone's kind of using all the main sources. But I kind of really wanted to immerse myself in the story because it's confusing
yes.
in a way.
Yes.
Because there's a lot of lies, obviously, and there's a lot of different versions of certain stories. So I would have to kind of be like, well, she said that in this Vanity Fair article, but then later on in the Ankler article, this is said. So I would try to find sometimes like find out which one was the truth. And sometimes I couldn't.
Yeah.
Because it was written either incorrectly or everyone just has a different version. It's weird.
I have a question. Is her Twitter account still up? Even though I know she like left Twitter, but she was really active on Twitter.
She's very active on Twitter. I actually don't know, but when I would click the tweets, they wouldn't go to anywhere. So I don't know if she deleted the tweets. But it didn't go to her account, though. So I bet you she's not on Twitter. She's very like isolated and not out in the world
right now.
So I doubt she's on Twitter.
Yeah.
But she was very active. Anyway, Elizabeth grew up in a middle-class Jewish family in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. She had her mom, Joan, who was a special education teacher, her dad, Robert, and an older brother named Eric. It was at Cherry Hill High School that she developed her love for writing. They had a very active theater department, and Elizabeth wrote plays for them to perform. She eventually went to college at Carnegie Mellon, and it was here that she had her first experience with cancer. Her mother was diagnosed with the disease. She would later write about the experience, quote, "Our family were all experts in pharmacology, wig design, hip hospital lingo, and fashioning surreptitious means of throwing up in public places." Her mother eventually went into remission, and Elizabeth was off to USC Film School. After that, she got her first industry job working as an assistant to television writer Rick Cleveland. When his mother was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer, Elizabeth was the one who would do all the research for him as far as treatments and other helpful information regarding this cancer as he was navigating the situation with his mom. She did the same thing for Rick when a good friend of him was diagnosed with breast cancer. She was like into like finding out like how to help these people. It was Cleveland who introduced her to writer-producer Alan Ball, who was creating True Blood at the time. And she was hired to write on the show, which was her first official writing gig. Around this time, she also began writing personal essays. Her first one about cancer was written for a personal essay site called Fresh Yarn. I actually wrote some things for that site. it was like the personal essay blog. Like,
what was it called?
It was called Fresh Yarn. So it was like a lot of TV writers in LA wrote for this site because the woman is based in LA. So this was not about her cancer. It was about her experience dealing with her mother's cancer and how it led to her being tested for the BRCA gene mutation, which she tested positive for. And this was where she kind of nailed her essay style, which was very dismissive of doctors, especially if they were men who weren't taking her pain seriously, like that kind of thing. And how she was really brave standing up to these doctors, saying things like, "I could tell the doctor wanted me to cry, but I wouldn't like give him that satisfaction." So that was her sort of defiant style, which you can see why people would relate to, because a lot of people have horrible experiences with doctors.
Yeah, there is a lot of, obviously, I don't know if it's her truth or her experience, because who knows what the fuck her experience is.
Exactly.
But that is a real issue that women, black women especially, have historically with doctors, where they don't believe pain.
Right. So it was something that people latched onto. So it's like, who knows if she knew that that was like the way to go or what.
It's a real issue.
Absolutely. But all of her issues are real issues. That's the thing.
Yeah.
So her personal essay was obviously a success, and she decided to mine more trauma for the basis of a play that she wrote. This was about an ex-soldier with PTSD who stalks his ex-girlfriend, something that she claimed was based on her own experience with an ex. In 2012, she landed a gig writing on The Vampire Diaries. This was a very difficult writer's room experience for her. Elizabeth was described as meek, full of anxiety, and she was definitely worried that she'd be the next writer fired if she didn't step up more, in the writer's room. It was at this time, after going in for knee replacement surgery, that Elizabeth claimed she was diagnosed with cancer. Chondrosarcoma, a rare and most always fatal bone cancer.
Wow.
So this is a very serious form of cancer. She told people that they found a tumor on her spine that was too risky to remove surgically because it could possibly paralyze her. So she began chemo immediately. After starting chemo, her head was bald and she walked around with a bandage, which she said covered up the chemo port. And she really started showing up to work looking very sick, like you would be if you were going through chemo.
Yeah.
One family member spoke of talking how she might die. She was talking to Elizabeth how she probably will die of this disease, and that they would lie in bed together crying about the situation. Finch kept her parents away. People were baffled by this, but she was like, oh, they're really overbearing, and I don't want to be around that energy while I'm sick. The parents are obviously crushed that she kind of shut them out. Her brother, Eric, who was a doctor, would also request to speak to her doctors to kind of get a handle on the situation and relay it back to the parents, but she refused to set up those meetings. She would fly back to the East Coast for occasions like her mom's 60th birthday party. And people were just like so impressed by her resilience. All of her odd behavior was chalked up to her being extremely independent. She was treating her illness with a quiet dignity. And that was what was happening, according to them. So obviously she's still writing TV, and she even had dream jobs in mind. At the top of the list was Grey's Anatomy. In February of 2014, she wrote about her diagnosis of chondrosarcoma in Elle magazine. This essay is almost like an audition to write for Grey's Anatomy. It's very dramatic. It has the feisty heroine who makes things difficult for her doctors with her sassy, attitude. One of the quotes from the article: when I defied Dr. Cryptic's orders to take an indefinite leave of absence from my work, he thought chemo deserved my sole attention. He doubted my commitment to getting well. She was not going to let cancer stop her from living, goddammit. She also wrote, like, I watched producers' cuts under a fog of Demerol, punched up dialogue about vampire-werewolf hybrids with a shunt in my spine. Yes, I was down 17 pounds, bald, vomiting relentlessly, but I was still living alone, still stubborn as hell. I mean, you can just picture how people read this, and obviously you never doubt someone's claim that they have cancer.
No.
So you're reading this and thinking, damn, like, she is like, wow, like, I'd be curled up in a ball. Like, yeah, whatever.
You'd be like, wow, this is one tough broad.
Yeah. So after this article came out, a development executive at Shondaland, which is the production company of Shonda Rhimes — she's obviously a huge producer, writer. She is the, creator of Grey's Anatomy, which was in its 10th season. They were looking at her as a potential hire for that season. She meets with Shonda Rhimes. Everyone is very impressed with this article. And Shonda offers her dream job, basically, to write on Grey's Anatomy. And she did, pretty well by all accounts. As I said before, this show is custom made for strong women who have this deep well of personal stories to draw from. If you've watched Grey's Anatomy, you know they have very interesting medical cases, interpersonal dramas, and it's always very unique. And you know it's coming from someplace, like, personal.
Yeah.
So a few seasons after starting, they hire a new head writer, Krista Vernoff. She took over as showrunner, and she did like a blind read of all the writers to see like who matched her voice the best. Elizabeth didn't make the cut and was let go. But someone in Shondaland was like, you got to read this Elle article. And Krista read it and she reconsidered and they rehired her. So wow. She got lucky. Unlike on The Vampire Diaries, Elizabeth is very comfortable in this room. She often dominates meetings, sharing stories, confessing secrets about herself. Like, this is all very encouraged in this room. So she, like, shines in this environment. Diversity is also very big in this room. And her diversity, and she talks about with this with a Hollywood Reporter, is that she's the only person in the room with a disability. So everyone, you know, makes her feel real at home and she fits right in, et cetera. So she, no one loved laying their pain bare more than Elizabeth. She's like custom made to do this in the writer's room. She also has a morbid sense of humor about all of these stories, which is perfect for a show about doctors. As we all know, they can have very dark senses of humor.
God, just knowing in hindsight that she was cracking dark jokes about cancer when she didn't have cancer.
It's crazy.
It's sick to me.
It's so sick. So, and some people would say, like, when she'd laugh at these, like, later after they found out, they're like, was she laughing that we didn't know? Like,
right.
That was what was so funny to her.
Right.
Like, every day she showed up, her skin was yellowish with makeup trying to cover it up. She obviously had her bandages. Her head would be covered with scarves. And sometimes coworkers would hear her vomiting in the restroom. Some days it would seem so bad that they were like, please go home and get rest. And she's like, no, no, I really need to be here. Please just let me stay for one more hour. So people were like, damn, she is dedicated to this job. She didn't turn down all the perks of her illness, though. She got an extra special comfortable chair. She had something that some of the writers described as talking rights, where no one would interrupt her when she would tell a story and she could take her time telling it. And many coworkers would later say that this is kind of unheard of in a writer's room where everyone's just kind of yelling out things and like whenever they think of it or whatever. And they're like, anyone else would have been fired for being such an attention hog. Like, right. It just doesn't happen.
Right.
But one writer was like, we all tolerated it because we thought she might be dying, that these might be her final words.
Like, without the context of her illness, her personality would be irritating to
people.
She's
a blowhard.
Yeah.
Yeah. So writers started noticing things, though. Like, her flare-ups often would happen around the same time she had a deadline. And other people would pick up the slack for her, obviously wanting to help. She also got extensive leave. So she would often want to go to these clinical trials. One of them was at the Mayo Clinic. She got an apartment near the Mayo Clinic. She even had a friend come with her who would drive her to her appointments at the Mayo Clinic and would just drop her off in front, of course.
Right,
right.
Right.
Sometimes she would snap a picture of the exterior of the Mayo for Instagram with tags like, there are giants in the sky.
Come on.
Yeah. She always declined offers of friends who were like, I'll go in with you and like hold your hand during the appointment. She's like, no. I don't want anyone connected to my cancer memories. That was like the things she would tell them. Sorry. In 2017, she got another devastating bit of health news. She needed a kidney transplant. She posted on Facebook, 2 hospital hangouts, nearly 2 weeks of hell, but finally one happy, healthy kidney. Thanks for all, heart emoji. She told another writer that Anna Paquin was to thank. And this is left very vague. Like, did she help you with the kidney transplant? Did she
pay for it?
Give you her kidney?
Right.
Like, what? But no one really knows. And this is a piece of the information I was looking for. It's also that she has one kidney now, even though she got a transplant. This is what I was trying to figure out. So maybe she lost both kidneys and was saying she had one. It's very confusing.
But a kidney and Anna Paquin was involved.
Yes. Paquin will later say that she had nothing to do with any of the kidneys. Like, kidney, yeah. Nothing. And she tweets a lot about her illness and things she has to go through because she has this serious cancer. She goes to Israel at some point, and she throws a fit when they make her check her bags because her cancer meds were inside the bags. She tweets, at Delta, you cannot insist a cancer patient check meds, lose the bag, and insist nothing can be done. None of this happened, though. She doesn't have cancer. Like,
this is awful.
At her 40th birthday party, she speaks of her illness.
This is, like, again, this is another issue because there are disabled people who have a really difficult time sometimes traveling on airlines, and these are very real issues people go through. And this is, like,
she's just making a mockery of it.
It's like so insane.
So she's like, everyone here in this room is someone I know and love, and over the last very bizarre 7 years has been instrumental in helping me get to 40, including... They don't want to be identified personally, but there are two doctors from the Mayo Clinic who flew all the way from Minnesota here. I promised that I would not show you guys who they were, but I wanted them to be surrounded by my friends and family who I love so fiercely. Like, that is deranged.
Also, this is very bold because what if someone from the Mayo Clinic, because like she had a big following on Twitter.
Yeah.
She had a big account. And like, what if somebody who worked at the Mayo Clinic was on Twitter and saw that and was like asking her coworkers, like, hey, do you know this lady?
Yeah. It's wild. Like, that's what I mean. It's not that I could never understand doing anything like this remotely, but if I did, I would keep it real close to I would be like, yeah, I have cancer. I don't want to talk about it. I wouldn't be making tweets. I wouldn't be adding Delta.
Right.
Like, I would keep it like to the minimal possible lie, right? Like, that's just me. I'm not going to do it at all because I can't, I would never recover from being busted.
This is a very special type of mind.
Yeah. Shame works on me. Like, I'm not going to do anything that will make me ashamed. And this is very shameful to me, this behavior. So cancer becomes her kind of beat in the writer's room, even though there are other cancer survivors in the writer's room. She's kind of like, I have it now. Like, that's her thing. Sometimes writers will push her back on like an emotional direction, and she starts lashing out at people when they kind of confront her or like disagree with her. She says things like, this is how it feels to have cancer, and none of you could know or understand. She would storm out of the writer's room. And some of the survivors in the writer's room said they started not even chiming in because it wasn't worth dealing with these emotional outbursts. In 2018, her experience becomes a major storyline on Grey's, and she writes the episode that launches the storyline. It's called Anybody Have a Map? It is, so basically, one of the doctors on the show, her name is Catherine Avery. She's married to Richard, who is the head of the hospital. This character is played by Debbie Allen. She gets the same cancer that, Elizabeth has. And she's very based on Elizabeth. She's like, you better fix my cancer. Cut that thing. You better cut that tumor off my spine because I got to go to work and have surgery in the morning and I can't be paralyzed. Like, that's like the doctor's vibe. It's very still working. It's like what Elizabeth thinks she is, right?
Right.
This fucking hero and this miracle who's going to like do this. So this is like a pretty long story arc, obviously. At the end of this episode, her husband, who does a voiceover in the episode, says, the problem with all the how-to step-by-step books, they don't take into account the exceptions to the rules. They never leave room for the outliers, the geniuses, the miracles. I mean, he's talking about his wife, so that's like acceptable. But Elizabeth's basically talking about herself. That's how she sees herself, is this sort of exception to the rule. Like, she's surviving this very difficult cancer to survive. She has it young. It's like something like usually older people get. So she's just this like, you know, random outlier who's also a miracle and a genius and everything. So when this storyline comes out, obviously people interview Elizabeth about it. And she claims in one of the articles that she really resisted sharing her personal story.
Come on.
She said, I wanted to say no. A big, fat, super empathetic thought, though ever polite, no. But her coworkers insisted, and so she broke down her wall. She said, I said yes because Shonda once wrote an email where she told me, love yourself more. And when Shonda says something like that, you listen. Now, according to someone in the writer's room, the conversation went more like this. Elizabeth, it would be so amazing to give Catherine my cancer, but maybe I shouldn't write it. It might be too triggering. Everyone in the room, okay, we'll protect you. Someone else can do it. Elizabeth, no, I can do it. Now, look, this is not a woman who had any trouble writing about her cancer. She had, by this point, written 8 cancer-themed articles, including, I confronted the doctor who missed my cancer. She also wrote something called Deciding to Have an Abortion While Getting Chemo, Redefining Brave, All My Eggs in One Basket About Her Cancer and Fertility Choices. She even wrote some of these at Hedgebrook, which is a competitive writer's retreat for female writers trying to bring about positive change in the world. And she used her illness to get in. That was like part of her application process to get into this exclusive writer's retreat.
She's like the Rachel Dolezal of cancer.
Yes. So she also would pick fights with people, not just Delta online. She would tweet things like, "Talk to me when you've screamed yourself to sleep at night from the pain, and I'll argue about the merits of legalizing marijuana every damn where."
Whoa.
She would also write things like, "I've officially run out of ways to politely say, stop tweeting me miracle cancer cures. It's exhausting and insulting and presumptuous as fuck." So she was like going overboard, in my opinion. Like, you don't have to go at people on Twitter like that when you don't have a fucking like leg to stand on. Like, you don't have cancer.
She's taking real people's grievances and struggles, people who have had cancer before or illnesses.
Yeah.
And just applying all of them to herself and making it her struggle. I just can't. I can't believe it.
Well, it's about to get worse because she continues to experience a variety of traumas that she will start to use in similar ways. So after Trump was elected in 2016, she claims that someone left an anti-Semitic symbol or note outside of her door. She posted the picture with a tweet with the message, "Yes, I am the only Jewish person in my building. Yes, I am the only one who received this on my doorstep. No one knows if this is true." In March of 2018, during the Me Too, like the height of that movement, she wrote in The Hollywood Reporter about an alleged harassment she endured years prior by a director on the set of another show, and also claimed there was misogynistic verbal abuse and unwanted touching. When Brett Kavanaugh was nominated for the Supreme Court, she used her cancer abortion story for a PSA video by that Now Democracy group who used to do all those videos, telling people that the ability to have an abortion saved her life, and also claiming in the video, "I may never be cancer-free." On the day Christine Blasey Ford testified, she went on Facebook saying, "Men, find a way today to tell women in your life that you believe them. Don't assume they know. Not today. Believe survivors." I mean, none of these are necessarily bad things, but she was definitely always inserting herself into like everything and talking about like her personal connection to these traumas, which who knows? They might be true. I have no idea. But she did not have an abortion while chemo, obviously. But that video, she talks about having an abortion while on chemo. It's all a lie. Like, it's crazy.
That's the thing that's so fucked up is because any of these other traumas or even like whatever, any of these bad traumas that you just mentioned besides having an abortion on chemo, they could have happened to her.
Yeah.
But I don't
know. No one knows what
to believe.
Fucking
believe anything she says.
Well, it's like the boy who cried wolf. I mean, that's a story for a reason. That's a moral story, like, for a reason.
I mean, and this is like the most extreme example of that.
Right. It gets worse. In October of 2018, the national tragedy hit the country when 11 people were shot and killed at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh.
Oh my God, this story. I'm sorry.
So, yeah.
It's
awful. So she has a connection to Pittsburgh. That's where she went to college. The next day after the tragedy, she began telling people a friend of hers she met in college had been one of the victims. And once again, she really was mustering up this fury on social media, saying, "Please don't send me photos of people who were murdered. That's my friend," stuff like that. She asked Grey's Anatomy writers to be careful with their language, even getting mad when people would say things like, "Oh, that pitch was shot down," like stuff like that. She's like, "That's triggering me." A few months after, the narrative started to change. She said that she helped clean up the remains of her friend's body from the synagogue floor. This was to be in compliance with Jewish custom that they should be buried 24 hours after they die with all of their body parts. And subsequent shootings would always bring the trauma back to Elizabeth. There was the mosque shootings in New Zealand. After that, she also tweeted things about her friend who died in the Pittsburgh synagogue shooting. So she would just like always jump on these other shooting tragedies with her personal connection to a shooting tragedy. Eventually, her cancer plot sort of ended on Grey's Anatomy. And she, you know, started latching on to a new character. This was a troubled young surgeon named Joe Wilson, and she proposed a storyline that happened to a friend of hers. After meeting a patient who is a rape victim, Joe starts confronting her own past as an abused wife and learns that she's a product of rape. Now, according to other writers on the show, writing the first episode of this storyline was so stressful for Finch that they all had to obviously help her write it. She couldn't do it. It was so stressful. But then she obviously wanted to work on Joe's storyline for the rest of the season. Discussions were made in the room about Joe needing to check herself into a mental health facility to deal with the trauma. And Finch was like, I need to check into a mental health facility to deal with my trauma. So she got a 6-week paid leave to treat her PTSD that happened to her from the Pittsburgh shooting. She checked herself into a mental health clinic in Arizona, and she started going by the name Joe, the name of her character. And it was here that she meets a woman named Jennifer Beyer. And we will take a break here and get back into it.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
I'm the queen of starting a free trial offer and forgetting to cancel it, oftentimes being charged for months for something I'm not even using. If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes, but let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. With Rocket Money, I can see all of my subscriptions in one place, and if I see something I don't want, I can cancel it with a tap. I never have to get on the phone with customer service. They'll even try to get you a refund for the last couple of months of wasted money and negotiate to lower your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is take a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. It's definitely saved me money, and now I can use that money to waste on things I do want. So stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Hollywood Crime Scene. That's rocketmoney.com/Hollywood Crime Scene.
So Jennifer Beyer, who is Jennifer Beyer? In January of 2019, Jennifer Beyer, who was a registered nurse in Kansas, arrives at this Arizona mental health treatment center. She's really stressed out. She thinks she will never see her 5 kids alone again. She's suffering from severe PTSD. And a lot of this is due to this traumatic 18-year marriage she's had with a man named Brendan, who she says is an abuser and master gaslighter. So on the surface to all of their friends, of course, they seemed like the ideal couple, but obviously there's a lot going on underneath it all. So Jennifer says that he is controlling. He controlled every movement that she made. He's also physically and sexually violent. You know, it's the classic abusive relationship, like all of her bruises and broken bones were the result of falls, etc. His line was that she was mentally ill and suffering from postpartum depression and that she was making it all up. And according to her, if she told the truth, she wouldn't make it. So she, of course, was fearing for her life. She took out a protection order against him and filed for divorce. This forced him out of the house, but he was always nearby watching her, according to Jennifer. Now, the incident that sort of brought her to the Arizona Treatment Center was when she began having dissociative episodes, like a break from reality, not knowing where she was. One incident happened in December of 2018, and she was with her kids. So she basically pulled over thinking she saw something, got out of her car, left her kids alone, cops arrived, and she looked like she had abandoned her kids. So they were sent to CPS. And then this began this whole custody thing with her husband, who now had this to use against her. So she enters the facility basically unable to function. She is afraid to even speak because she doesn't want to be diagnosed with anything because she thinks that that will, you know, interfere with her custody. She begins working with a therapist named Carly. Carly diagnoses her with PTSD, and that's what's causing the dissociative episodes. And she determines that she's determined to do whatever it takes to bring Jennifer back to health, even if it takes months. So disturbing news from home doesn't help. Making matters worse, Brendan is now being arrested. He's taken to an emergency room, and the kids are sent to foster home. Mm. So they're not even with their dad. They do eventually end up being split custody with the foster home and Brendan's mother. So 6 months into her stay at this Arizona facility, a new resident arrives named Joe, and she becomes part of Byers' process group. Joe is also suffering from PTSD. She tells the group about her friend and the shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue. She is also unable to talk. She's, like Jennifer, scared when sudden noises happen. And Jennifer's kind of comforted that a big TV writer is experiencing the same type of PTSD that she is. They begin talking and are soon inseparable, even becoming roommates, which is uncommon apparently at this facility. But everyone agrees that it's for the best for these two women. Now, when Jennifer sort of confides to Elizabeth all of this stuff about Brendan's abuse, Elizabeth starts revealing to her that her older brother, Eric, had also been cruel and violent to her as a child, something she had never grappled with until this very moment. Elizabeth's parents come to visit her, so she has to quickly tell everybody her name isn't really Joe, but she just used it because she's such a successful writer, she wanted to kind of be anonymous. Her parents come, and they hear for the first time about Eric's abuse at these group meetings that they're allowed to sit in on. And they're shocked because they have no idea any of this happened. They've never seen anything that she's describing. But they do their best to listen and to make her feel heard and believe her, all of that kind of stuff. The next meeting, the parents join, and the mom starts to speak how much she's been worried about her daughter her whole life, but especially since she was diagnosed with cancer. The group is shocked. None of them knew that she had cancer.
Because she hadn't, that wasn't the narrative.
No, and she's not doing anything like she did before, she has her hair back. She's not doing like the bandages. She's like, yes, I do have cancer, but I don't want to talk about it here. Like, that's not what this is for. It's like, yeah, but you can't really turn cancer on and off when you're dealing with other things. Like, that's not how it works. So she also starts really becoming invested in Jennifer's abuse. She finds out that Carly has the possession of Jennifer's phone, Brendan's sending texts to her, and sometimes Carly will tell Jennifer what these texts are or show her the videos of him saying, I'm coming to get you. They actually get security at the facility to protect her. And Jennifer, looking back, is like, she was always very interested in hearing all of this stuff about Brendan, specifically what type of things he did, et cetera. Now, at some point, her parents leave. They leave a family photo album. And Elizabeth is flipping through it. And inside, she finds a handwritten letter from Eric threatening her. She tells Jennifer about this letter. While she's holding it, she tells her all these details, but she never lets Jennifer look at the letter. She's just kind of holding it. Mm. By early July 2019, both women are ready to leave the facility. Jennifer is in need of a service dog to help her with PTSD incidents that might happen. And Elizabeth buys it for her because Jennifer has zero money, obviously, and can't afford it. So everyone's like, wow, what a fucking angel. Like, right. You know, it's just such a nice gesture. They plan on keeping in touch before they leave. Elizabeth returns to Hollywood, and she quickly tells her friends about all of her new trauma with her brother, Eric. She elaborates on the photo album letter. She says that the letter has written in it, keep your mouth shut. She also starts adding details about Eric's abuse, and all of these details are very identical to things Jennifer told her Brendan did to her while they were married.
Sick.
Back in Topeka, Jennifer is miserable without Joe. She still calls her Joe, even after finding out that's not her real name. And she begins living in a shelter and going to custody hearings. That's kind of her life. She only sees her kids once a week. And Brendan begins taunting her, posting pictures of her location on Instagram. Luckily, Joe saves the day once again, inviting her to stay with her at a huge mansion in Ojai, the house that belongs to her friend, Anna Paquin. Elizabeth says she's part owner, which is a lie. Joe claims to have security there so that Jennifer will be safe. And this is the weekend where they basically fall in love. Like,
yeah,
they have a blissful weekend in Ojai. Who doesn't fall in love in Ojai?
That's what it's made for. I love Ojai.
We should go. It's so nice up there.
It's so magical.
So Elizabeth continues to love bomb Jennifer when she returns to Kansas. And she even tells Jen the importance of honesty to her.
Great.
She says, "My expectations are and always will be this. Don't lie to me. That's all I ask. It can annoy us or bum us out or even hurt us, but truth will out always." And that's a Shakespeare line.
That's what Elizabeth said to Jennifer?
Yes. So she even begins going to Kansas to kind of be emotional support for Jennifer at these custody hearings. And stands up to Brendan, like, in the courthouse. And Jennifer is just, like, impressed how fearless she is. On September 5th, 2019, Jennifer is actually in California on the Grey's Anatomy set when she gets a call from the Kansas Department of Children and Families in Topeka. She's told to return to Kansas immediately because Brendan has killed himself, the children's father.
Yeah.
So the kids are safe, and they both immediately, you know, Elizabeth is like, "I need to go to the Grays." Once again, she needs to take some leave to go. And they're like, of course. Yeah, obviously. Yeah. She goes back to Kansas, and they have to obviously tell the children. Just awful. 2 weeks after the suicide, still in Topeka, Elizabeth writes the following email to the writing staff of Grey's Anatomy. She says, "Hey, all. I've been absent, coming back tomorrow. I just don't know who's looped into what, and I'd rather put it out there so no one's in the dark or feeling eggshelly. I've gone because my brother died by suicide."
Stop it.
"He was on life support for a short while, but ultimately did not survive. I say this not because I need or want anything from anyone. I'm not a delicate flower or whatever. I just want people to know I'm still here, still part of the team. I intended to just power through my episode shoot, but I recognize I needed to just take a bit of time away to process. Miss y'all, Finchie." She gets back to the Grey's Anatomy friends. I'm sorry, her Grey's Anatomy's friends. And she tells them that because Eric was a doctor, he knew exactly how to shoot himself without killing himself, which forced her to be the one to pull the plug. And she's like, that was his final act of vindictiveness. And all of her Grey's Anatomy friends cried with her. So now she's kind of really living two separate lives. She has this one with Jennifer and her coworkers, and they each have different lies. They go on a trip to Hawaii, and obviously she tells Jennifer this is a work trip. She tells her Grey's Anatomy's friends that she's going to Hawaii to reunite her dead brother's illegitimate Filipino baby with the baby's mother in Hawaii. Like, why would you even go that far with this lie?
Why? What is the point?
I have no idea. Maybe to get the time off and to explain why she was in Hawaii. I have no idea.
It's just like everything has to be so over the top.
Yeah. So in Jen's version, though, the brother is alive and terrorizing her.
Yes. Here, just saying, like, the drama of, like, oh, I'm going to Hawaii to reunite his illegitimate kid with the birth mother or whatever. She could have just said, "I'm going there to spread his ashes." That's where he wanted his ashes spread.
I know. That's what I keep doing. I'm like, why would simplify it? Like, yeah, simplify things. It. Don't make it bigger. So she's telling Jennifer that he's alive. He's breaking into her home. He's trashing the place. He leaves empty alcohol bottles everywhere. And this actually makes Jen panic because she's like, I'm trying to get my kids back. I can't be in a dangerous situation. And Elizabeth quickly course corrects, and she's like, oh, actually, Eric's gone to the Philippines per a legal order, and he can't return to the country without me being notified. And Jen's like, oh, okay, I guess I can continue this relationship then. So soon after she's in Kansas, she's helping Jen now clean this house that Brendan trashed before he died. She meets some of Jen's friends, and she's like, I'm missing the Emmys to attend. So they're all like really impressed that she would do this. No one knows that the Emmys were actually months before. It's a complete lie.
Yeah.
And one of the friends is just post on Facebook, the more I get to know Finchie, the more I realize she is actually a superhero masquerading as a regular person. So she's really built this little image up. On Thanksgiving, she proposes to Jen. They want to get married as soon as possible, hoping that this marriage will help them sort of get the custody, like that a stable home will help her get the kids back. She can legally adopt the kids, etc. And she tells Jennifer, Elizabeth tells Jennifer, she's like, look, I don't want these kids ever back in foster care. If anything ever happens to you, I will take care of them. And this is obviously very comforting to Jennifer to know her kids will be taken care of. And they start calling her Finch Joe Mama. Now, the first crack in this facade appears to Jen while she's in, while Elizabeth is in town to see Jen's son perform in the Nutcracker. She starts experiencing what she thinks might be kidney stone pain. But she, of course, does not want to go to the hospital. And Jen basically insists that she go. She drives her to the hospital. When they're face-to-face with the doctor at the hospital, Finch is telling the sort of symptoms and what's happening. And Jennifer is like blown away that she's not saying anything about her medical history, like that she has cancer,
right,
that she's had kidney transplant or one kidney. And she, like I said, she's a nurse, so she kind of knows how things are right, and how things go. So she's really blown away by this. She eventually convinces the doctor to give her a CT scan. And he's like, well, this will solve everything. And he says to her, the kidneys are fine. So Jennifer's like, kidneys? She only has one kidney. And she tells Elizabeth this, and Elizabeth's like, oh, he probably just meant my one working kidney looked fine. And they didn't pay attention to my pain, though. What about that? So she is using these true and real problems to kind of manipulate situations.
Yeah.
Jen, of course...
Real problems of other people.
Of other people, yes. Jen, of course, ignores her doubts, and in February of 2020, they are married. Now, as we all remember, COVID hits soon after, so they're kind of stuck in a house together. Everyone's number one goal in life becomes making sure that, Elizabeth does not get COVID because she's so vulnerable,
right,
with all of her illnesses. So they're bending over backwards to protect her. When the summer and fall of 2020 happened, that brings more stress to Elizabeth. It's not only the anniversary of her brother's suicide, but she's really traumatized by like the protest, anything that has firecrackers or loud sounds. Because remember that period where there was fireworks always going off things like that? And everyone had all these conspiracy theories about them.
Yeah.
So everything was bringing back the Tree of Life trauma that she experienced, in quotes. Jen begins to get suspicious again, and she starts, what we all do, going through social media.
Yep, yep.
Why she waited this long, no one knows. She goes to Facebook, begins scrolling. She goes back to the day of the Tree of Life shooting, and she sees that Jen has posted that she's out with a friend. It's just her and a friend doing things, just normal things, out pictures of them doing things that day. She looks through more the day after. She sees more pics of Jen's with friends. I'm sorry, not Jen. Elizabeth with friends at dinner. She starts panicking the more she's scrolling and the more she's scrolling. She sees pictures of Elizabeth when she had the bald head, but her eyebrows and eyelashes were still full. And obviously, right, she's a nurse, so she's like, that's not how it works. You lose your hair. You don't keep those things and right, lose your head of hair. So she also is kind of like seeing these pictures of her with this bandage over what she's describing as her chemo port scar. And she's like, I've seen your naked body. You don't have a scar where a port was. And that's like a pretty big incision.
Yeah.
She's also noticing that the bandage itself looks really shoddy. Like no one would ever put this kind of grubby bandage on something that would be so easily infected, especially right, with a cancer patient who has no immunity. So she's kind of like, that's not how you would ever do it. And this is not professionally done. This is crazy. So all of these fears are really sinking in for her finally.
Yeah. Oh.
And she begins to plan a confrontation. Knowing Elizabeth's personality, she's like, I need to take this slowly and sort of, you know, ease my way into it. The first thing she does is ask Elizabeth what medication she's on. Now, this is something in the past that Elizabeth has found very triggering. And she's like, my brother always questioned me. I can't deal with this. But she finally rattles off this long list of medications. And like I said, she's a nurse. So she hears one and she's like, that's very toxic to one's kidney functions. There's no way a doctor would put her on that medication.
Yeah.
They finally get a loan from the kids one day, and she finally gets some concessions. Elizabeth admits that she did have cancer at one time, but she got chemo and recovered, and she had a hard time giving up the attention, and she continued to pretend that she had it. So this was still seemingly a lie to Jennifer, though, because she's like, okay, but still, where is your port scar? Like, you still don't have that, even if you survived cancer. And she quickly, like, she had nowhere to go with that one. So she said, I think, you know, Jennifer's like, I think there's more that you're not telling me. So she just kept putting it off and putting it off. She's like, fine, you can put it off. But when we go to California to look for houses, you need to tell me everything.
Yeah.
So that doesn't happen. Elizabeth doesn't admit to Jen anything. And Jen's just like, forget dipping my toe in the water. I'm just going to unload all of my suspicions on her, including the fact that she's like, I feel like you were targeting me. I feel like you mirrored me. I think that you wrote the threatening letter from Eric. And I don't think the details about the shooting were real. Like, she just is like, here's what I think is true.
Yeah.
And Finch doesn't really admit to anything, but she doesn't deny it either. Jennifer said there was no emotions and no tears, and Finch only maintained that she was the victim of her brother's childhood cruelty, and that was one thing she was not going to give up. So Jennifer obviously is like, I can't live this way. Like, I can't keep this all to myself. I need you to fucking tell people. I need you to tell your family and friends what's going on. So they tell the friends in Kansas, the ones that Elizabeth just met, and they kind of stand by her. Like, they're like, oh, we get it. We understand. And then she goes behind Jennifer's back and tells them that Jennifer is falling apart because of her past traumas. And she thinks Jennifer is conflating her with Brendan. And they believe it. They think Jennifer is the one who has the issue. Jennifer eventually reaches out to Carly to get referrals for another therapist. And Elizabeth reveals that she has been behind her back working with Carly and is planning on going on a 4-week retreat with her. And this feels like another betrayal to Jennifer, because she's like, you stole all the details of my life. You stole my trauma. You stole my friends. And now you're stealing my therapist.
This like, is so fucked up.
Yeah. And adding to the stress of it all is that Carly is providing reports to the Child Protective Services in order for Jen to get the kids back. And now she's concerned that if she pisses Elizabeth off, she'll badmouth Jen to Carly. And like, that could screw up her custody. And like, Elizabeth has that over her, like, this custody. So Byer calls up after she finds out this, she pulls up an episode of Grey's Anatomy that was written right after Elizabeth left the retreat. And Joe is working with her therapist, a character named Carly, at a mental health facility. And Joe's story is exactly what happened to Jennifer with Brendan. She has an abusive husband who beat her, who died. Like, it's all of Jennifer's story was used for this Joe storyline. So she feels, she's really low. Like, she feels completely defeated by all of this. She actually checks into a hotel and plans on taking her own life.
Oh my God.
Luckily, she doesn't go through with it. She gets into a car and starts driving to Arizona, the facility where she met Joe or Elizabeth. And she calls her and tells her that you've won. Just go back to Kansas, take the kids, just get whatever you want. The kids love you. She's like, I only ask that you don't post pictures making yourself to be the hero who rescued the kids from the sick wife. And Elizabeth goes there. She goes there and talks to one of Jennifer's daughter, who is obviously fucking traumatized. Her dad, you know, killed himself. She's worried about her mom doing the same. She starts confiding in Elizabeth, will my mom ever get better? And according to the daughter, Elizabeth encouraged these fears. And she leads this child to believe that she is the one that you can always count on,
this
not your mom.
This is disgusting.
Yeah. So despite all of this, Jen is still willing to work on the marriage if they go to counseling. They do go to counseling. And she's still insisting upon this, like, massive confession to everyone in their lives. And Elizabeth eventually, after saying she will, she gets so fucking irritated with Jen pressuring her to do the right thing that she files for divorce and leaves the marriage. Now, in February of 2022, Jennifer gets a forwarded email from someone in the Grey's Anatomy writer room. Like, that was on that email that Elizabeth sent to her coworkers telling them about her brother's suicide. And she realizes that this is the first time she's seeing this email. So she's like, oh my God, she used Brendan's suicide as a story for herself, saying her brother is the one who killed himself. Now, she really hadn't grasped, even at that point, she's like, I still hadn't grasped how insane it all was.
Right.
So she finds Shonda Rhimes' email in this like email chain, and she writes her an email saying, please stop letting Finch tell her stories anymore because there are other survivors' stories. She doesn't hear back from Shonda Rhimes, so she texts showrunner Krista Vernoff the same message. And shortly after that, she gets a call from Disney's HR department. At the time, Shonda has produced and is releasing Inventing Anna.
Yeah.
Which is about a con woman named Anna Delvey. And it's like they have their own version of that in the writer's room at this very moment. And
right.
No one fucking knew. So word quickly begins leaking out about these accusations in the writer's room. And coworkers are like going over everything that she did with a fine-tooth comb. I mean, you can imagine.
Oh, my God.
You can imagine.
Can you even imagine just the energy in that room where you're rethinking?
They were vibrating. The room was vibrating.
Every conversation you've had with this woman. And, oh, my God, I remember when she did that. And the barfing.
Just go. It's like the end of fucking The Usual Suspects where you're just looking at everything and realizing where all the lies came from.
Oh, my God.
Some of the things they noticed or pointed out immediately was, like, the episode of her first cancer storyline episode was called Anybody Have a Map? And that is from a song in Dear Evan Hansen, which is about a compulsive liar, another kid who does a lie.
Yeah.
On her 44th birthday, she posted an Instagram album cover of The Greatest Showman about P.T. Barnum. So, like, has she been dropping clues all along? Like, so they're at that level now where they're looking at every little detail. So her lies are finally exposed. She hires Andrew Brettler, who is a attorney who represents Prince Andrew, Chris Noth, and Armie Hammer. Not exactly the best cast of characters there. And the network begins an investigation. So the network ends up not proceeding with this investigation because Elizabeth quits. So they don't really have a reason to continue. I would still continue it personally. On March 31st, just to get the details, on March 31st, she says in a statement to like the Hollywood trade outlets, Grey's Anatomy is one big-hearted, brilliant family. As hard as it is to take some time away right now, I know it's more important that I focus on my own family and my own health. I'm immensely grateful to Disney, ABC, and Shondaland for allowing me to do so and for supporting me through this very difficult time. So everyone in her life at this point is really like, why? Why? Why did you do this?
Yeah.
I mean, so many, you know, obviously, like, she hurt people. Like, people are damaged by what she has done. Like, even though she didn't steal money or, like, whatever, like, she has ruined people's lives and, like, hurt them and traumatized them.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy. A former coworker of hers said, searching for the why puts her at the center of our thinking instead of the people who have been hurt. And she said that she had a dream about a therapist showing up and telling her some behaviors you'll never make sense of. And she said, I felt like it was my subconscious telling me, if I go down the road of trying to understand her, I will only be in a circle. I will never get a satisfactory answer.
She's a fucking narcissist.
Yes. Whatever her motivation, whatever her rosebud sled is, if we find it, even if she tells us, how can we even believe it? And she says at this point, she may just be a shell of a person. Like,
yeah.
So that's where we're going to end. We'll pick up with her explanation in the minisode.
Wow, Desi, that was incredible. I obviously read the story when it came out and I was obsessed with it, but hearing it all over again, I can't wait to hear this interview.
Yeah.
To hear what she has to say for herself.
Yeah. She has some explanations. So,
well,
it'll all be cleared up soon.
Okay. Bye.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.